Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Tet Amud Bet, 7 lines up from the bottom. The Gemara asked a question based on the Mishnah. The Gemara just came to the conclusion with regards to the issue of a chazakah, a husband and wife are unable to establish a chazakah with each other. But the implications of that, as well as the implications from the Mishnah, are that a chazakah is problematic because of their relationship, because of the nature of their relationship. They can't establish a chazakah one on the other. But a chazakah is a means to get out of the necessity to provide evidence of the fact that you purchased the property so that you do not have to substantiate your claim. But haraya, if you actually do have a documentation of a sale between the two parties, or you have edim to the fact that there was a sale between the parties, so haraya, yesh, that would work. Tema, she can make this claim. Nachat ruach, asiti lebali. So Gemara says, how come? Don't we have a problem, which is the claim that the woman could make, and we discussed this in yesterday's daf as well, which is that the woman could say, I didn't want to upset the apple cart. I didn't want to upset my husband. So I acquiesced to a sale, or I acquiesced to a sale to my husband because I didn't want to upset him at the time we were married, and I didn't want to cause him any angst, and therefore I agreed to the sale, but not that I really wanted to sell it, not that I really meant to sell it. So why can't we make the same claim? Even the face of evidence, milot nan. We have a Mishnah that indicates that way. Lakach min ha'ish. If you purchase the property from the husband, v'chazar lakach min ha'isha, and then after that you went and purchased it from the woman, mekcho batel. You are not successful in acquiring the property. Alma amra. The reason that you're not successful at acquiring the property is nachad ruach asiti lebali, because she can make this claim that the only reason I signed on to the documentation to say that I would sell it to you is because I didn't want to upset my husband. I didn't want to ruin our marriage or cause friction in the marriage. So I just signed on to make him happy. But that no intention of really selling it to you or giving up my rights in the property. Hachanami. So also over here, Teima, Nachadua, Chasita the Bali. So to over here, when she have a document that indicates she sold it to her husband, just say that she did it because she wanted to make her husband happy, not because she had really any intent of selling the property. So the Rashbam, in addressing your question, says, why is this different than Talyul? When you string him up and he agrees to a sale under duress, why isn't that considered over here also to be a sale under duress? And so, good, goes through. So the Rashbam says something interesting over here. He says, Avahocha, deleka ones kolkach, lo gamra of aknia. That here there's not, the duress is not absolute. What the Rashbam is indicating is that you need both things in order for the sale to go through, which is you need an absolute duress, plus you need remuneration that was fair remuneration, consideration for the property that you sold. But it's only because you reached that point of duress that was so strong that in the end you say, I'm just going to sell it because I don't want to continue like this. I am unable to persist under this pressure, and therefore I sell it. Over here, it's not like that. She's just doing it to make her husband happy, but she's not really under that type of duress where she's gamar umakne, where she really reaches that full conclusion that I'm really going to sell it and get it out of my possession. So the Rashbam uses almost the opposite logic, which is that you need full duress or absolute duress for the sale to have a kinyan and have a gemirat adat. Over here, you don't have that because the woman just did it. She wasn't really thinking about it. She really didn't sell it with a full heart. She just sold it to take care of a husband. Obviously, there are others that learn the other way around, which is nachad ruach asiti lebali, is the equivalent of a moda'a. It's the equivalent of saying that before I sell this, just know that I'm under duress here because I have other factors or considerations that are making me sell it. And it's as if there's a declaration beforehand saying that whatever sales that I undertake are done under duress. And of course, a moda'a works if you have that declaration ahead of time. And so to over here, she has, as if implied, declaration that any sale that she engages in is not a sale. And the Rashbam thinks it's a failure in absolute duress. Others are saying that, no, there's equal duress over here, just that there's a moda beforehand. It's interesting the Rashbam takes this approach. Now, others take an approach that, of course, in a situation where anus gamur, we say that the transaction goes through, then in cases of lesser anus, it should certainly go through. And therefore, they cannot subscribe to this position of the Rashbam. And therefore, they explain the situation here where there was no money that exchanged hands. If you remember before, that this position of Rav Huna, that when under duress, one is considered to have gone through the sale, that's only if there was proper consideration that was given. And so the situation over here is they're edim to the fact that the woman admitted to selling or giving the property to her husband. And therefore the explanation here of lakach mena ish, v'chazar lakach mena isha, according to the Rishbam, it is a case of monetary compensation where he purchased it from the man and then purchased it from the woman. Over here, just going to assume that the edim are telling us that the only evidence that this individual is bringing is that the woman agreed to the sale, not that there was any money that exchanged hands. And that what means, b'chazar lakach mena isha, doesn't mean that he went back and then purchased it from the woman, but simply got her acquiescence to the sale without an exchange of money. So the lack of money is what makes it that this sale is not considered to be a valid sale. So now the Gemara is in a sense in a bind, which is our Mishnah seems to indicate that you have the ability to generate a sale between the husband and wife, and it'll go through, meaning that it's a valid sale. And over here we have a Mishnah indicating that the opposite, which is that when a woman signs on to a sale, that's not classified as a sale. Which is it? Can a woman sell the property? Or is the woman's sale of a property always problematic because of this claim that she has that Nachat Ruach Asiti Lebali? So the Gemara answers, Hayit Marla. We have a qualification of that Mishnah, which is, Amar Rabba Baravuna, Lo Nitzricha. That Mishnah is speaking about these particular cases. Ella, Botan Gimel Sadot. These specific three properties. Achat Shekatav La Biktubata, Achat Sheyichad La Biktubata, Achat Shechinisa La Shum Mishela. That only in these three properties is the Mishnah speaking that we say that Nachat Ruach Asiti Liba'ali. But in other situations, that would not be the case. Obviously, the other situations is going to become the important part here, because that's what's going to be spoken about in our Mishnah. That Mishnah is dealing with these particular cases. The other cases are what our Mishnah is dealing with. So we're going to get to the other cases in a second. The first thing we have to determine are what are these three cases over here? What are these three fields that we're speaking about? Three different opinions about this, because we have them on the daf. You have the Rabbeinu Gershom, the Rashbam, and the Baal Tosafot each give different interpretations about what these three fields are. Just know that there are even more opinions surrounding this, but here, at least just for a sampling, you'll see what they say. The Rishbam says that, achat, the first one is that, shekatav la biktubata, it was a field that was incorporated in the general lien that the woman gets in her ktubah. In the ktubah, it says that you have a lien on all your husband's properties. Included in those properties, he happened to name this property. So this property was named specifically, but not because you have a greater lien on this property than any other property, but it's just named in particular in the ktubah. The way that ktubah works is that he's in all of his assets are mishubad. She has a lien on all entirety of his assets because even if they exceed the value of the ktubah, if he transacts in them, then she needs her lien to be on the remaining assets of the estate. So given that, it was mentioned in the ktubah, but under the general lien of the ktubah. The second case is achad sheyichad laktubata is a case where after she has the regular ktubah, and that she has a lien on all of his assets, he goes ahead and specifies a specific property for her to have a directed lien on that property. This is your primary property for the collection of your ktubah. So he specifies or designates this piece as being the one that she collects from. V'achat shechnisa la mishum shela. Again, this is the girsa that the Rashbam has over here, which is something that he brings in, mishum shela, under her assessment. And the way that he reads that is that it's Nichse Tzonu Barzel. Nichse Tzonu Barzel are property that she brings in as part of her dowry into the marriage, in which there's an assessment of the value of those properties. And that assessment, the husband basically guarantees to give back to her in the back end. He does not have to give the property back. He can do what he wants or what he pleases with the property. He just guarantees the amount or the value of that property he will return to her. In this instance, what he did was, after guaranteeing that value in the ktubah, he also kept this land as collateral for that purpose. So, you know, technically, he could do what he wants with the property, he could sell it off. But meantime, he does have an obligation that's associated with the value of this property that was brought in. And he made this sadeh as a shibud in order to protect or to cover that value that he has guaranteed inside of the ktubah. So here are three different fields, according to the Rashbam, where there is specific connection between these fields and her ktubah. And therefore, she would have more interest in seeing these fields remain under the auspices, or under his asset umbrella, because these are the assets that she is relying on in order to get her money back or get her ktubah in the case of divorce or in the case where the husband predeceases her. That's the way the Rashbam learns. The biggest problem with the Rashbam is that achat shekatav la b'ktubata, v'achat sheyichad la b'ktubata. From the Rashbam, it doesn't sound like way, because in the second case, he didn't be miyached in the ktubah. According to him, it happened all after the ktubah. It happened after they were married already that he designated the property. And number two is, he wrote a piece of property into the ktubah where it has no meaning because it's under the general lien. Doesn't seem to be that something that is separate. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he gives an alternative, which is, achat shekatav la b'ktubata, shaita lo sadeh gdola, sheshaveh yoter mishir ktubah. He has a large tract of property that is valued at greater than the amount of her ktubah. And then he writes that you have a right to take your ktubah from that field. So that's a case of shekatav la b'ktubata. It's a case where he writes in the ktubah a specific field whose value exceeds the value of the ktubah. V'chat sheyichad la b'ktubata, the case of yichad la b'ktubata is shaveh k'neged ktubata. He assigns a tract of land that is equal to the value of her ktubah. And then the last case is a case achat shechnisa la shum mishelo. You can see that he has a different girsa than the Rashbam. The girsa that we have in the Gemara is a girsa that follows Rashi and the Rashbam, which is shechnisa lo shum mishela. Over here, you see that Beinu Gershom and most of the other Rishonim have a girsa, which is achat shechnisa la shum mishelo. This is property that he brought in. L'tosefet keneged nedunya. He added on monies to the ktubah to offset the dowry that she's bringing in. She's bringing in a dowry, and now he in the ktubah guarantees a certain amount of money against that, or extends what's called the tosefet ktubah, the addition to the ktubah. When we read the ktubah under the chuppah, you'll notice that they list out the basic obligations that are associated with the ktubah, which are the 100 or 200 zuz. Then after that, they speak about the dowry that the woman brings in. And afterwards, there's a tosefet ktubah that he adds in. That tosefet ktubah, we see in the end, sach hakol. In totality, he gave her the 100-200, which is the base ktubah, plus the additional tosefet. That's what we're speaking of over here, is the tosefet keneged nedunya. That's the Reina Beder Rabbeinu Gershom learns. And now, the Balei HaTosafot to give a third possibility under the Rabbeinu Chananel. Chaki Garcina beperish Rabbeinu Chananel. V'chat hachnisa la mishum shelo. So you see that he has the same girsa as the Rabbeinu Gershom, not the girsa of the Rashbam. He favors the one that says mishelo. And this is v'hachi perusho. Let me explain to you what these three different fields are. Achat shekatav la b'ktubah mana umatayim. V'meh she'adam notein mishelo, shayach l'shon k'tiva v'lo l'shon l'ichud. V'chat sheyichad la b'ktubah tachat ha'nedunya she'aviyah mibeit aviyah. So he explains the difference between, what does it mean, katav la b'ktubata versus yichad la b'ktubata. Katav la b'ktubata is something that a person gives of his own. I mean, it's his own property that's being put in there. Sheyichad la b'ktubata is something that's an exchange for the dowry that she brings in. So one is collateralizing the core ktubah, and one of them is collateralizing the dowry that she brings in. So in a case of katav la is a core obligation that the husband has. So there, he writes to her, or he encumbers a field to her that will cover his core obligations in the ktubah. Sheyichada is not something that he's obligated to give her, but rather it's something that he uses to protect the money that she brought in. He's designating a field to protect the dowry that she brings in. And then, v'achad shechnisa la shum mishelo, shesham la sadeh keneged tosefet, shehosif la mishelo amaneh matayim. That's the third area, which is his tosefet, what he brought into the marriage, and then he designates collateral to cover the addition that he brings in. So the way the Balei Tosafot are basically learning it, and that's what I pointed out to you before, there are three stages where we read in the ktubah. There's the core ktubah, which is the 100-200. That's what he says, shekotav la b'ktubata. That was the collateral that he gave for that core obligation. The second thing we write in the ktubah is the dowry, what she brought into the ktubah. Over there it's sheyichada, that he designated collateral to cover that. The third thing we write in the ktubah is tosefet, what he added on top of his core obligations, and that's which, v'achad hechanisala shum mishelo. That's the case where he brought in additional monies of his own, and then he's collateralizing that. So those are the three different pieces of collateral. And now the Gemara says, lemutei mai. What does that come to exclude? Those are included in that Mishnah that we quoted from Ktubot, but where is the exclusion, or where are the fields that are excluded from that that would be covered by our Mishnah, which say that can be sold, or you can't have a contract that says that she sold it. She doesn't have a right to say, Nachat ruach asiti lebali. So Gemara says, Ilem elemutei shar nechasim, if you're talking about other properties, kol shekein davi le'eva, then certainly there's going to be more acrimony in the marriage, damar la, because he's going to say to her, Einayech natan begerushin ubemita. You're like cheering for a divorce over here. You're thinking about a divorce or my death because that's why you want to secure all these assets. The way that the Rashbam learns it, and this is based on his explanation that we saw before about what these three fields are, that the Kol Shekein or the Kal V'Chomer is the following. Those three fields all have relevance to her ketubah. In the case where all three fields have relevance to her ketubah, and we still say that when she says, Nachad Ruach Hasiti Debali, we listen to her, then it's certainly in fields that are not specifically designated as collateral for her ketubah. If she goes ahead and then says, I'm not going to sign onto a deal like that, clearly it looks like she is hoarding assets to make sure that she gets her ketubah paid out. And that's what he says, the Gemara is saying. Gemara is saying that you're going to create more acrimony in the marriage if you're talking about assets that were specifically designated for the ketubah and she refuses over there. You could understand maybe why she would refuse over there, because she's saying you're giving away the things that are protecting my ketubah. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says she can say Nachad Ruach Hasiti LeBali, and she signed on to it. If she can say it there, then certainly we could say that there was acrimony, or that she could claim Nachad Ruach Hasiti LeBali when she sells assets that are not designated for this particular ketubah. So that's the way the Rashbam learns it, but that's the Rashbam l'shitato, that all the properties that we spoke about here were properties to protect what she brought into the marriage, or the obligations there, the Nechseitzon of Barzel, or that which protects that she is entitled to in the ketubah. So in those cases, she can make such a claim, then certainly she can make such a claim when it comes to free assets, assets that are encumbered and generally to the ketubah, but they're not specifically encumbered. And the way that the Balei Tosafot learn it is, Shar Nechasim over here are the Nechsei Tzon Ubarzel. Because according to the Rashbam, Nechsei Tzon Ubarzel were one of the three fields that we spoke about. According to the Balei Tosafot, the Nechsei Tzon Ubarzel were not mentioned in the three fields that we just mentioned. Because one of them there was to protect her core rights in the ketubah. The second one was to protect the dowry that she brought in. And the third one was to protect his Tosefet Ketubah. And therefore, their Girsa in the Gemara is not the Mute Shar Nechasim, but rather the Mut Nechasim Dida, to exclude property that is hers in particular, which are Nechasim, like Tzon and Barzel. Because you would have thought, since the husband is guaranteeing the total value of the property, there's no reason for her to object over here. In the end, what we say is that her lack of objection really derives from that, and it's a kol shekein, because over here she has no reason to withhold the property in protection of the asset, since the husband has guaranteed the value, and therefore her lack of objection can be a claim of nachan ruach asiti lebali into the marriage. So that's what the Balei Tosafot say over here, the me'ute mai, what is that coming to exclude? Nechsei Tzon and Barzel over here, the Gemara says, Skoshkein havya eva, certainly over there would be eva, because the husband says, listen, I guaranteed you the price. I guaranteed you the value of these assets. Why do you care whether there is collateral over here or not collateral over here? The only reason you want collateral over there after I've guaranteed you the value of these properties is because you're thinking about divorce, or you're thinking about that there might be some poison in the soup tomorrow, and I'm going to die, predecease you, and then you're going to get these assets. So given that, it's a kol shekein. So now the Gemara says that the case is elam utei nichsei melog, comes to exclude the case of nichsei melog. So in the case of nichsei melog, you have a hava mina to say that the woman does have a right of refusal. And that's what will differentiate nichsei melog from other pieces of property. So in other pieces of property, the Mishnah and Ketubot will govern, which is that you can never make a claim that the woman sold the property to her husband or signed on to the property in a sale to another party, because in all those cases, she can make a claim of Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBali. I did it because I didn't want to cause quarrels, acrimony, problems in my marriage, so I just signed on to be a good wife. So therefore, she can always afterwards say, it was under duress, I didn't really mean it, and she can back out of the sale. The one instance where you don't have that is by Nichsei Melog. Because the way that Nichsei Melog work is that she brings those assets into the marriage and she remains the principal owner of those assets. The husband only has rights to eat the peirot, which is the production of that field, the leasehold on the field. That's what he's entitled to. So then, in that case, if she exercises a veto right, it will not be a problem of eiva. That veto right will simply be her saying, these are my pieces of property. I have no interest in selling the principal amount that underlies them. You want to sell what you have, which is the value of the peirot, go ahead. But I'm not signing on to sell those properties or the principal amount. They are my property, and I will retain that right. So over there, her refusal to sell is not going to cause eiva in the marriage, because the husband doesn't own it in order for him to sell it and then say to his wife, please sign on. She owns it. And so if he's going to sell it, she can just say, you're selling something that doesn't belong to you. That's my property. I'm not selling my property. I have no interest in selling my property. That she has a right of refusal. There we will assume, if she signs on and does sell it, that she intended to sell it. And therefore, if you have a documentation that says that she signed on either to sell those to her husband or to a third party, we will believe that documentation, and she won't have a right of saying that they're under the umbrella or rubric of Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali. So that's how we would differentiate between our Mishnah and the Mishnah in the Ketubot. Just to know over here, there is a machloki between the Rashbam and the Baalei HaTosafot as to when she says Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali, which gives her a right to upend the sale and to say that it really wasn't a sale, when can she exercise that right? So the way that the Rashbam writes it, and the Baalei HaTosafot over here quote that when she says Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali, that she only has a right to do that Mishat Shreifa, which is from the time that she wants to go collect the properties. When she wants to come and either exercise her right to collect her ketubah, or in a case where her husband predeceased her and she inherits all of those properties, or the properties come into her possession at that point, that's when she gets the right to say, Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali, I never really meant to sell them. And that means that prospectively, at this point, she will then own the property, and then she takes over the rights to the peirot going forward. But until that point in time, the peirot belonged to whoever they were sold to, and that right of exercising Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali is only a prospective right that she can exercise after the passing of her husband, or at the point in time when she wants to collect her ketubah. But before that, it remains a good sale. On the other hand, the way Rash used this is that right to indicate that Nachat Ruach Hasiti LeBaali is a mechanism that undermines the transaction completely. It says Mechol Batel, the transaction is completely invalid, and she can exercise that right to say, listen, I only did it to make my husband happy. The transaction never really happened or never really was valid. And therefore, I want my property back. And she has a right, in a sense, retroactively to go and invalidate the sale. Given that she can undermine the sale completely, that means that she's entitled to go back, say the property belonged to me all that time, and that maybe even you have to repay me for the peirot that you ate during that period of time because I never really agreed to the sale. It never really was a valid sale. So now the Gemara says, V'ha'amar ameimar. Didn't ameimar say, Ish v'isha shemachru b'nichse melog? A husband and wife that sign on to the sale of b'nichse melog, lo asu v'lo klum. It is meaningless. It doesn't work. So now we have a problem. We just said that the solution to the problem of what happened in our Mishnah was a case when they both signed on to the sale of b'nichse melog, or in a case where the wife sold the b'nichse melog to her husband. Now we have ameimar seemingly saying that when both of them sign on to Nichsei Melog, it doesn't work there either. Now that we solve the difference between the Mishnayot, we have another problem, which is a memra from a memra, which seemingly indicates that it doesn't work. If it doesn't work by Nichsei Melog, that really eliminates that option as being the way to explain our Mishnah. Obviously, our Mishnah would govern versus a memar, but the only reason that our Mishnah says this is because we narrowed the case of our Mishnah to say only be in this case. And now we find a memar saying that this case, it doesn't work. So, ki itmar da meimar, says, no, you didn't understand. A meimar's position is, heicha de zavin ihu umit. It's a case where he sold it and died. Ache ihi umafka. She has a right then to go and take the property back. Inami, in a case de zavna ihi, she sold it. Umeita, and then predeceased her husband. Ate ihu, then he can come umapik, and he can take it away from the buyers. Betekante derabonon. Based on the Takanat Ribbanan, Ukta Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, based on this memra of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, Dama Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, Be'usha Itkinu, when the Beit Din was, or when the Sanhedrin was located in Usha, there were a number of Takanot instituted, we bumped into them through the different Masechtot in Nezikin, which is these Takanot, which are mostly about family life and responsibilities of parties to each other. One of those takanot was Aisha Shemachra b'nechsei melog, a woman who sells her nechsei melog, and then predeceases her husband, Abal motzi miyad lukuchot. The husband has a right to come and take it away from the lukuchot. So let's remember that nechsei melog is really a joint ownership between the husband and wife. The wife owns the principal of the property. The husband owns the output, the leasehold on the property, the rental income, or the production rights to the property. So they are, in a sense, joint owners of the property. So what you could have happened, and this is what we're in a Maimar's position right now, it's not in a case where they both signed on to a sale. It's in a case where each one of them individually sold their rights to the property. The woman went ahead and sold her principal rights to the property. The husband retained his rights of eating the payroll. So the husband has two rights in the property. One right is the production rights, the leasehold in the property. He also has the right that if his wife predeceases him, he is the inheritor of the property. So what the woman did was go ahead and sell the principal rights that she has in the property. It would seem from that that she has a right to do that because she owns the underlying property. So when she does that, during the lifetime of her husband, it is meaningless because the husband has the rights to eat the payroll. Given that, she sold the underlying rights that she had, but it didn't change the circumstances because the husband still has the rights to the payroll. But at the point she passes away, at that moment, the ownership that she has should then transfer over to the first buyer. Who's the first buyer of those principal rights? The person she sold it to while she was still alive. She said, basically, you can have these rights to the property that, first of all, if my husband predeceases me, then you will gain the principal rights. Or, if I predecease my husband, you will also be the first buyer of the principal rights. You will supersede my husband's right to inherit the property. That's what should have happened. So all that time, he has the right to the payroll, because that's his right under the nechsei melog until the death of his wife. But, in Usha, they came along and gave the husband super rights. And that is that the husband, even though he's an inheritor of his wife's property, he also becomes the lokeach rishon. He's considered to be the first buyer of the property. And therefore, when the wife passes away, he has the first rights to go get that property. Even if she pre-sold those rights, he becomes the erash of the property because he's classified as the first buyer. So now, if the woman sold the property, the principal of the property, to someone, that person is taking a risk and a known risk. Therefore, he'll pay less for it, which is that the only way that he'll be entitled to the principal rights of this property is if the husband predeceases the wife. In that case, she takes over ownership of the property, and her principal sale will go into effect then, and then that person will own the property. And if she predeceases her husband, then even though technically he was the first buyer, this buyer the principal, we've moved the husband up, and that's what Maimar is saying. The husband has a right then to go take the property. Her sale is completely invalid. Now in the reverse, what happens if the husband sells his rights in the property? The husband has rental rights, payroll rights in the property. He can sell those rights to someone else, which is basically renting out the property or the leasehold in the property. He can sell that to someone or he can take cash for that. But that's all he is able to sell. He's not able to sell the underlying principal of the property. And therefore, if the husband predeceases the wife, then that right terminates and the wife gets the property back and she can throw off whoever's on that property at the time. And that's what a Maimar is saying, that each party here, whether it's the husband or wife, when they sell whatever right that they own in the property, if they predecease the other spouse, that right terminates, and the other spouse can go and take the property. So that's the statement of a Maimar, that when it comes to nechsei melog, no one party has a right in their sale of that right that they have there to supersede the other spouse's right. Not when they sell together. That's what our mission is talking about. Our mission is talking about when they both sign on to a deal, or the wife sold it to the husband. In that case, yes, the ownership can transfer. Yes, you can bring proof, and it would be a valid sale. What we're talking about here is where one of them sold it independent of the other, and given that, the other spouse now can, after the death of the spouse that sold, they can go and exercise their right to keep the property. In a situation where they both sold it to the public at large, I mean they both signed on to it, or in a case where she sold it to him, that is a full-fledged sale. And that's what our Mishnah is speaking about. The case in our Mishnah, which is differentiated from the Mishnah in Ketubot. The Mishnah in Ketubot says the woman has this claim of Nachat Ruach Hasiti de Bali to upend any sale. Our Mishnah is talking about the case of Nechsei Melog, in a case where either they both signed on to it, or in a case where she sold it to her husband, that would be a valid sale, and even a Maimar would agree to that. That's a valid sale because either they both signed on to it, or she sold it to her husband. Those are valid sales because it's Nichsei Malob. In a case where she can't make the claim of Nachat Ruha Chasiti the Bali because she has principal ownership, and she won't be afraid of her husband to demur her in that case to say, no way, I'm not selling this property, it's mine. You can't force me to sell it. And she won't be embarrassed, and it won't be Ava, because she really owns the rights to this property. So that's the case. A Maimar's case is a case where either one of the spouses independently sold the property, then the other spouse still has a right to go and claim it after the death of that spouse that sold it. V'bay Dema, some say, a Maimar damar k'Rabbi Elazar. You know what? A Maimar does argue on our Mishnah. A Maimar disagrees with our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that if either both spouses sign on to a sale of Nechsei Malog, or the woman sold the Nechsei Malog to the husband, you can't establish a chazakah. A Maimar comes along and says, no, you can't do that. Now, a Maimar is an Amora. Obviously, he can't argue on our Mishnah. So what a Maimar now needs is a Tana that supports his position. And that's what the Gemara says, that a Maimar is subscribed to this position of Rabbi Elazar, which will take us a while to get to. The Tanya, we have a Braita. A Mocheret Abdo, Upasak Imo, Yimash Meshenu, Shloshim Yom. A person sold a slave, an Eved Kanani, but he retained the rights of usage for the next 30 days. So he basically sold him for it, and then it's almost like a sale leaseback where he sold him, and then for the next 30 days he remains renter, or the ability to utilize the Eved during that period of time. So now, who is considered or classified to be the owner of the Eved Kanani in that period of time? The reason is because the Psukim and Mishpatim tell us that an Eved Kanani has a unique standing with regards to the death of an Eved Kanani. With regards to a Bar Yisrael, a regular Jew, if someone hits or injures a party, even if that party, after being injured, has a slight recovery or is able to live for another 24 hours and then deteriorates again and passes away, you will be responsible for the death of that individual, because the death of that individual was precipitated by the injury that you caused them. So even though the person was able to survive for 24 hours, that's not an indication that it wasn't your injury that caused their death. It simply means that there was a delay, or that they were fighting to recover during that period of time. But afterwards, when they deteriorate, you are responsible for the death of this individual. That's also true by an Eved Kanani. An Eved Kanani has the same din as a full-fledged Yisrael, and thereby if someone injures the Eved Kanani, they will also be subject to this same rule. There is one exception to that rule, which is the owner and an Eved Kanani who injures the Eved Kanani. If he is able to survive, the way that the Torah expresses it is Yom O Yomayim, for a day or two, doesn't literally mean a day or two, it means 24 hours, me 8 by 8, for 24 hours, because sometimes 24 hours could be one day, sometimes 24 hours could stretch over a two-day period. So if he survives for 24 hours and then passes away, the owner is not subject to the death penalty in that case. It's a gzeret ha-katuv by an Eved Kanani, but it is only a dispensation for the owner of the Eved Kanani. So what we're trying to determine at this point is, who is the owner of this slave at this point in time, who gets that dispensation that if he survives for 24 hours, they will not be subject to the death penalty. So over here, you have two possibilities, because he sold the slave, I mean the underlying principal amount of the slave, he sold already, but he retained usage rights for 30 days. Who is the owner, right? So similar to Nechsei Malog, which is, who is considered the owner when one person holds the principal rights and one person holds the leasehold rights or the rental rights or production rights in the item? Amucheret avdo, upasakimo yisham shemenu, shloshim yom, Rabbi Meir omer. Harishon yeshno bedin yom o yomayim. The first one, the original owner who sold him now, is classified as the owner during this 30-day period, mipnei shehu tachtav, because he's under his auspices, meaning that he's working for him. He is classified as the owner. Vasheni, enu bedin yom o yomayim. The second party, the one who bought him, is not classified as the owner. Mipnei, sheinu tachtav, because he's not under his auspices, he's not working for him. What is an Eved for? Elaim Kain, for his avodah. Meaning that the principal rights of ownership to an Eved are meaningless without the output of the Eved. And as the Rashbam points out, that's the only value that is manifest in an Eved, is his kinyan peirot. Similar to land, where the only value is the production of the item itself, the residual value in the land is only in its future production, and same with an Eved. as opposed to an animal or other assets which have underlying inherent value independent of their productive capabilities. An animal has value in its productive capabilities, but even after it dies, you can use it for meat, you can use it for other items. So the asset has independent value from the kinyan peirot, as opposed to the case of the eved, where the entire value is premised on its kinyan peirot. Therefore, the one who has control over the kinyan peirot is the kinyan aguf. He is considered or deemed to be the owner in this case, because owning the underlying asset has no value aside from its kinyan peirot. Given that, then the one who owns the output, the one who has the rights to the output, is classified as the owner. Kasavar, Rabbi Meir obviously holds kinyan peirot ke kinyan aguf dami. When you own the production or the leasehold in an item, that is the equivalent of owning the underlying item. This has nafka minot, we'll see later on in the Gemara in Bava Batra, with regards to mikra bikurim. When you bring bikurim up to the mikdash, you need to own the underlying property upon which you are working and bringing the peirot from. What is classified as ownership of the property? The same discussion will come up there. If you are working the field and you have a kinyan peirot, you have the output of the field, are you considered the owner enough to go up there and do mikra bikurim and say, this is my land? Or is the kinyan aguf, whoever owns the underlying karka, he's the true owner, and he's the only one who can bring up the peirot, but the peirot aren't his. So he can't do mikra bikurim. Nobody can do mikra bikurim from that property. So what Rabbi Meir says is that kinyan a peirot, kinyan aguf dami. When you own the leasehold, the output, you in essence have some sort of principal ownership in this item. Given that, he becomes the primary owner of the slave, and he is subject to that dispensation, the rule of the 24 hours. Whereas the one who owns the Eved, the second guy, doesn't own enough to be considered the owner of the Eved. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Hasheni Yeshlo Bedin Yoma Yomaim. It's the second one, meaning the one who bought it from him, who is considered or classified as the owner, Bnei Shu Kaspo, because he is his monetary ownership. Harishon Enu Bedin Yoma Yomaim, Shenu Kaspo, because he is not his monetary ownership. Kasavar, clear that Rabbi Yehuda holds Kinyan Peirot, Lav Kinyan Aguf Dami. That when you own the leasehold or the output of an item, you're not considered to be the true owner of the item. The reason being is that the pasuk in Mishpatim, Michiyake Ishet Avdo, Oet Amato Bashevet, person who hits is Eved or is Ama, meaning Eved Kenani, or a Shifcha Kenanit, Shevet with a stick, he injures them, Meitach Yado Nakom Yinyakein, and they die, you're subject to a death penalty. You kill your Eved, you are subject to a death penalty. They are on equal plane. By the way, this is one of the huge chidushim in Parshat Mishpatim, vis-a-vis something like the Hammurabi's code, by where there were different classes of individuals, and a slave didn't have the same rights as another individual. It's still true today in certain countries that have caste systems, that if you kill someone from the lower caste system, you're not subject to the death penalty like you would be if you killed someone from your equal caste system or class. Over here, the Torah gives equal rights to an Eved Kenani as to a full-fledged Jew. And then Eved Kenani, if you kill them, you're subject to the death penalty the same way that you're subject to the death penalty if you kill a fellow Jew. So that's a huge chiddush of the Torah. I mean, that's a very advanced way of looking of the quality of people, and it doesn't matter who you kill. Now here's the exception. Ach, im yomo yomaim yamod, if he survives for 24 hours, meaning that he's able to get up or whatever the qualifications up, lo yukam, then there will not be a death penalty, ki kaspohu, because he is your money. So it's clear here that what Rabbi Yehuda puts an emphasis on is who is considered to be the monetary owner, kaspohu. And what Rabbi Yehuda says is kaspo is dictated by the underlying owner of the principal, the one who owns the eved. So now, the other opinion, which is Rabbi Meir, focuses on chiyake ishet avdo et amato b'shevet umei tachat yado. He's under his auspices. He is working for him. So Rabbi Meir focuses on the working. Now, what does Rabbi Meir do with Kaspo? He solves that problem by saying, Kinyan Peirot, Kinyan Aguf Dami. So your rights to the output of the Eved are the equivalent to real ownership. So he's both your Kesef and Tachat Yadcha. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says the most important aspect here is Kaspohu. That's giving you the reason why you get the exemption, and therefore only if you're the owner. And the only owner over here is the principal owner, because Kinyan Peirot doesn't give you real ownership in the Eved. So those are the first two opinions. Third opinion is Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shnehem Yeshnam Bedin Yoma Yomayim. They are joint owners. They both have the dispensation over here. Zeh Mipnei Shehu Tachtav. This one, because he's under his auspices, meaning the first one, the one who sold it to the other party, but retained the usage of the Eved for the 30 days, because he has the Tachat Yado aspect of it. And the other one, because he is the true owner, he's the principal owner of this Eved. So they both are granted the dispensation. And he has a doubt as to Kinyan Perot, Kinyan Guvdami, Ilav Kinyan Guvdami. He doesn't know whether Kinyan Perot grants you Kesef rights, principal rights in the Eved or not. And therefore, Safet Nimvashot Lehachel. Since we have a doubt about whether you're subject to the death penalty or not, you are released. We don't kill people based on a Safet. The simplest way to say this is that anytime you have a Safek, we don't take action. That's even true in monetary matters, as the Balei Tosafot will point out. When we have a Safek Mamon, we say, Amotzi Mechavero Alav Araya. We don't change the status quo. Similar over here, we have a Safek. We're not going to change the status quo. We're not going to put you to death based on a Safek. On the other hand, the Rashbam adds in the additional aspect of there's a responsibility on the Beit Din to Vishaftu Eida V'Tzilu Eida. That the Beit Din has a specific responsibility to be lenient in matters of nefashot, in matters of death penalty or capital punishment. Given that, the Beit Din is also charged here to be lenient towards them. The Balei Tosafot said you don't need that. Any safek nefashot would have that aspect. You don't need that additional aspect that the Rashbam is adding in. But either case, Rabbi Yossi says over here, we can't put either party to death because of this safek, and they're both classified as being owners because we're not sure if it's the tachtav that governs, or the kaspo that governs. And the Kinyan Peirot is also bisafek, given that neither party is going to be put to death. Rabbi Elazar, the one, this is what we were trying to get to. This is the fourth opinion in the Braita, and there's only one more opinion there to be left, which is Rabbi Elazar Omer, Shnehem Einam Bidin Yomam Yomayim. Neither of them have a din as being the owner. Zeh Lefi She'enu Tachtav, Vezeh Lefi She'enu Kaspo. Each one of them is missing an aspect of ownership over here. This is similar to what Rabbi Yochanan says about Hekdesh. Rabbi Yochanan says that a person can only be makdish an item if it's both in his ownership, meaning that he is the underlying monetary owner, as well as birshuto. It's in his possession. He both has ownership and control over the item. Then you're classified as an owner to be makdishit. But Rabbi Lazar is saying something similar over here, which is in order to be classified as the owner of the slave, you need both things. You need kaspo. It has to be your monetary, your principal ownership, but also tachtav. They have to be working for you. You have to have control or the output or the value of the production of this evid over here. So now, Amarova, my time with the Rabbi Lazar. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Lazar's opinion? Now, all the other opinions revolve around kinyan of perot. Are either kikinyan or guftami, lav kikinyan or guftami, or safek. Now, what's Rabbi Elazar's opinion? His opinion has nothing to do with kinyan peirot, because he is requiring both things be true. Amarkra, lo yukam ki kaspohu, says he's not getting up because he is your kesef, kaspo hamiyuchad lo. It's not only his kesef, his ownership, but it's ownership that is particular to him. The Rashbam reads this in one of two ways. Either the possessive form of kaspo is what the drasha is from, or the fact that ki kaspohu is completely extraneous because you don't need to tell me ki kesefu, he's his eved. What does kesefu come to teach you? So that's the way the Rashbam reads it. He reads both possibilities. But in essence, what it says is it's not enough to have monetary ownership. You need control. You need to be the one who is benefiting from the output of this item. Now, what we just said before is a Meimar subscribes to Rabbi Elazar. What does that mean, a Meimar subscribes to Rabbi Elazar? That means that a Meimar believes, like Rabbi Elazar, that in order to be an owner of an item, you need to have both aspects to be the owner. You need principal ownership, and you need to be the leaseholder, you need to be the one entitled to the output of the property. Wow. Without that, you have no rights of sale. You can't sell the item, you can't do anything with the item, because you're not the true owner of the item. So just like Rabbi Elazar says that you're not considered to be the owner of the Eved to get the dispensation of the Torah of Yom Yomayim. If you own one of these two aspects, you need to own both of them to be granted that right. So too, over here, a Meimar is going to say the same thing, that neither the husband nor the wife are considered to be the full-fledged owners over here, and therefore neither of them independently has the right to sell it. And even jointly, they don't have a right to sell it because neither of them has sufficient ownership over here in order to sell the item. Now, based on this understanding, it doesn't mean that a Meimar is holding exactly like Rabbi Elazar, because Rabbi Elazar's opinion derives from Gzeirat HaKatuv that demands both Tachtav and Kaspo, or Kaspo, Kesef HaMiyuchado. That's a specific demand over there. But as an outcome from that, what you learn from Rabbi Elazar means that there is this necessity to have complete ownership in order to be determined as the owner. And so relying on that or extrapolating from that, the Maamar says that should be true in our case as well. That the lack of complete ownership by either party is what prevents either party from making the sale go through. Despite the fact that together they own the totality of the object, each one individually doesn't own enough to be able to effectuate a sale. Hiksha Riva, the Riva says, how can you compare a Maamar's case to the case of Din Yoma Yomayim? That means the partners would never be able to sell their property. Because the way that you're expressing it now is that when you don't have exclusive ownership, you don't have a right of sale. So how can you say that a Maamar is exactly like Rabbi Elazar? Once you make a Maamar like Rabbi Elazar, you now prevent the ability of partners to ever sell. So the Baal Tosafot differentiates and says, no, you don't understand. A Maamar is a unique case that is similar to Rabbi Elazar, which is that one party has total control over the principal, and one party has total control over the output or the production of the field. If you are partners, where each of you owns 50% of each item, meaning that you're a 50% owner of the principal, and you're a 50% owner of the asset, and there, in that case, you can join together and make the sale. Because each party in their half of the shutafut owns exclusive owner, 100% of their 50%. They own both the principal amount as well as the output of the property. And therefore, it's different. You're not saying that a Maamar completely agrees with Rabbi Elazar, but Rabbi Elazar's uniqueness is the separation between the principal and the output of the property. If you have partners that are sharing in both items, then each one owns 100% of their 50%. They can sell that, or they can sell it jointly together to another party. And therefore, it would be different than regular shutafut. So that's why over here, the husband and wife may not be able to sell it, because each one owns the exclusive right to one of those two aspects. They don't own 50% of the principal and 50% of the output. One of them owns all the 100% of the output, and one of them owns 100% of the principal. And that's why they can't get together and create a sale, because neither one independently has a right of sale. And then given that, a Maamar's statement is that whenever you sell something where you're not the true owner of it, you can back out of it, because it's as if some third party sold the property, and you can always walk away from the sale because nobody else is entitled to sell your property. So therefore here, the husband or wife can walk away from the sale and say that they sold something that didn't really belong to them, and therefore the sale is not binding in this case. Obviously that argues on our Mishnah, where our Mishnah states that if they both the husband and wife sign on to it, it would be a valid sale. Or if the wife sold it to the husband, it also would be a valid sale. So our Mishnah would disagree with this, but our Maamar is backed by this position of Rabbi Elazar, and therefore you have a machloket Tanaim, which a Maamar is entitled to take a position with regards to which Tana he believes has the correct position over here. Okay, now the Gemara says, "V'lo ish chazaka b'nichsei ishto." Our Mishnah says that a husband is unable to establish rights in the property of his wife. V'amar Rav Eshet Ish tzricha limchot. Rav says that a married woman must object to someone taking possession of her property. Biman, who are we speaking about that is trying to take possession of her property? Ilei mabacher, if we're talking about a third party, v'amar Rav ein machzikim b'nichsei Eshet Ish. Then Rav say that you have no way to establish a chazakah in the property of a married woman. So that means that we can't be speaking about a third party, because a third party can never establish a chazakah on a married woman's property. The way that the Rishbam explains it over here, the Matzi Amra, she can always say, Abali samachti. I relied on my husband, shehu imche v'yarer, that he would praise the objection. I was silent, not because I believed you owned it, I just believed my husband took care of it. The fact that he didn't take care of it doesn't diminish my rights over here. My lack of objection is not because I acquiesced to your ownership, it's simply because I was relying on my husband. And that means there was a different reason for my lack of objection, not an acquiescence to your ownership. Now the Baal Tosafot say, what happens in a case where the husband forfeits his rights to the output of the property? He forfeits his rights to the production of the property. Obviously, we're speaking about Nixay Malog over here, because otherwise, there's no right of sale anyway. We just already discussed this, that the woman then can say, Nachad Ruach Hasid to the Bali. So the case here must be a case of Nixay Malog. What happens if the husband forfeits his rights to the Peirot in that case? Can the woman still say, I was relying on my husband? She has full ownership rights now. She owns the principal amount and the output of the property, because the husband forfeited his rights to the output of the property. Can the woman still say, oh, I was relying on my husband? The Baal Tosafot say yes, because what will happen if the woman predeceases her husband? The woman predeceases her husband will inherit the property, even though he's forfeited his rights to the peirot, and she owns the underlying principal. There is a case where the husband will become the owner of the property, and he has a vested interest in this property. And therefore, she can still say, I relied on my husband to object, because my husband has ownership rights. Maybe not today, but down the road, he can become the full owner, and therefore I relied on my husband. So the Balei Tosfot say, even with zero rights to the husband, she can still say, I relied on my husband because of his future right to inherit this property. That's enough reason for me to rely on my husband. So given that, the fact that the woman didn't object is never an indication of a chazakah. Now, even though Rav over here doesn't specify about whom he is speaking about, nevertheless, you would have surmised from his statement that he's speaking about third parties. Because first of all, he says, ein mafzikim in plural. And number two is we have our Mishnah that indicates that a husband can't establish a chazakah. So that would cause you to lean in favor of saying that it's referring to acher, it's referring to other parties. And so because of that, the Gemara's conclusion is that Rav's statement saying that there is no chazakah is speaking about other parties, third parties. Now, given that, we run into a problem now with Rav's first statement. Elalav babal. So that only leaves us one choice, which is it's the husband. The husband's exercising a chazakah on his wife's property, and Rav says over here, eshedish tzricha limchot, that the woman has to object. Our Mishnah says that a husband can't establish a chazakah on his wife's property. So Rav is arguing on our Mishnah, which is our Mishnah says, a husband can't establish rights in his wife's property. Rav's saying, if the woman doesn't object, the husband does establish a right in his wife's property. Amarova, the olam babal, yes, it is with the bal. Kagon, shechafer bar barot shechin umearot. He doesn't utilize the property for its output. He doesn't utilize the property as a leasehold on the property, but rather, he destroys the property. He ruins the property. It has to be a case where the property is not built to store water or to have borot shechin me'arot in it. And he's going ahead and he's damaging the property. So based on the fact that he's damaging the property, that will establish a right of chazakah here, because here the woman should have spoken up. Here he's utilizing the property not in the way that she expected. If he uses the property for peirot, then he can never establish a chazakah, because there's no way to differentiate between him utilizing the property with peirot because he is entitled to nechzei melot, or because he bought the property from the woman. There's no differentiation there. If he utilizes the property, you can't tell whether he's just acting as a husband with nechzei melot, or he's acting as the owner of the property. That's why you can't establish a chazakah. But if he acts in a way that demonstrates ownership that is not an entitlement under nechzei melot, that would establish a chazakah. Here he comes, destroys the property, does something detrimental to the property. That's not using it like nechzei melot. That is using it like an owner. In that case, if she doesn't object, then she loses her rights. Gemara says, wait, but then we say back on Daf Chaf Gimel, Vamar Rav Nachman of a Rav Avoyin Chazakah L'Nizakin, that damage is not a means for establishing a chazakah. Just because you, for the last 3 years, have done something that is detrimental to your neighbor, doesn't mean that you've established a chazakah now to continuously act in that manner or continue to damage your neighbor in that manner. He, whenever he wants, can put up an objection and say, I no longer want you damaging my property. And there's no chazakah for damage. Either because what the Rashbam says over here, which is, you're not using the property in the normal way that it is utilized, and therefore you can't establish a chazakah in that manner. Or because the owner of the other property, or the one that you were affecting, can say, I was too busy, I wasn't focused on it, and therefore I didn't object to that usage. It wasn't a complete affront to my ownership. It was just a damage that resulted from your usage of your property, and I had yet to have time to deal with it or to object to it. My says, Ema ain din chazakah l'nizakin. No. What does that mean that there's no din chazakah l'nizakin? It means that there's no requirement of 3 years to establish a chazakah by nizakin. So normally, in order to gain a chazakah, you have to wait 3 years because you're using the property in the normal way that it is used. On the other hand, if you use the property in a way that is so unusual, or something that flies in the face of the other individual's ownership, if they don't object immediately, they lose their rights. Because it's in your face. It is so obvious that this person is acting as an owner over here and taking rights, that you better object right away. You don't object right, you forfeit your rights. So that's what it means. When Rabbi Nachman says, in chazakah l'nizakin, means you don't need the requisite 3 years. Because with nizakin, you can establish a chazakah immediately. And so also over here, the woman has to object immediately, otherwise the husband's going to gain rights if he goes ahead and damages her property. Because right. The basic principle is that nobody stands by while someone else damages their property. So if they stand by, then that lack of objection is an acquiescence to the other party's ownership. Ibai Dema, Lavit Marala, didn't we qualify that statement of Rav Nachman? You might remember this again from back in Daf Chav Gimel. Rav Mari Amar Bekutra, it has to do with smoke. Rav Zvid Amar Bebeit HaKisei, making it into a outhouse. Meaning that there's certain types of nezek which never allow you to establish a chazakah. Light forms of nezek or inconveniences to the other party or things that are not pleasant to the other party, that if you do this for a period of time of 3 years, you can establish a chazakah. If you do damage that is so both pernicious and permanent in nature, then you have a right of objection. The person can say, I thought I could handle it, and I can't handle it anymore. Meaning that the smoke that is inside your house, that smoke keeps coming into your neighbor's property just because you've been doing it for 3 years, doesn't give you the right to continue to do it. Or if you set up an outhouse, he thought I could handle the smell, and then it becomes too difficult. They said I can't handle the smell. He has a right of objection at that point in time. Or in essence, what we're saying is that Rav Nachman's statement is that you can't have a chazak and a nizukin is only in these higher forms of nezek, meaning these more difficult and more damaging types of nezek, in those instances, you can't establish a chazakah. For more mild forms of nezek, you can establish a chazakah. So what you'd have to say over here is that the nezek of him digging up the field does establish a chazakah, because this is not that type of high level of nezek, which you can always retract. This is a type of nezek that will establish a chazakah for you, will take 3 years, but if you did it for 3 years, he's been digging up the field and leaving the field this way for 3 years, that will gain him a right of chazakah over here. So one way to solve the problem is to say that the way that the husband gains chazakah, according to Rav, is in a case where he uses the property in an unconventional manner. Since he used it in an unconventional manner, he gets a right to declare ownership over the property because of her lack of objection. If she didn't object, he gets to establish a chazakah. On the other hand, in a case where he utilizes the property in a normal manner, over there, she could have just said he was using it like Nixle Malog. Why should I have assumed that he was demonstrating ownership through his utilization of the property? I had no need to object. So we'll separate between Rav's din and the din of our Mishnah. And the din of our Mishnah is where he utilizes the property like he would utilize Nixle Malog. The case of Rav, where she didn't object, and that gives him the right of chazakah, is in the case of Nezek. What exactly we meant by Nezek? That was the two ways that we read Rav Nachman. Either Nezek gives you a chazakah immediately, because you're not using it like the way that people normally use it, or you can establish it over 3 years as long as it's a mild form of Nezek, and it's not this extreme form of Nezek. So that's how we will reconcile between Rav and our Mishnah. And then the alternative is, Rav Yosef Amar Olam Be'acher. Yosef says, no, we're talking about a third party over here. Ukugon She'achlam Mikzad Chazaka Be'chayei Habal. It's a case where he started to utilize the property while the husband was still alive. Ushlosh lachar mitat habal, and then 3 years after the passing of the husband. The husband sold him the rights, and he starts to establish a chazakah in the lifetime of the husband. Then the husband passes away, and he remains on the property for the subsequent 3 years afterwards. So at this point, the woman should have objected. If she didn't object, she's lost rights here, because when her husband passed away, the property came into her possession. She is the principal owner of this property. The fact that she didn't object now is going to lose her the rights. Migo, dibay amar lay, because he can say to her, ana zvinta minach. The guy could just say, I bought it from you. If he made the claim that he bought it from who, he would establish a chazakah, because he had it 3 years while it was under her ownership. So the fact that he could say, I bought it from you and I establish a chazakah, kiamar la nami, when he says to her, at zvinta lay, bizavna mihali, that you sold it to your husband, and then your husband sold it to me, Mehmet, he is believed. Meaning that in that sequence, he now has a migo, because he could have just made a direct claim or a better claim, which is, I bought it from you, and she have no rights over here, because he says, I don't need the contract anymore, you sold it to me, I've been here for 3 years while you had ownership, I can establish a chazakah. So now when he comes with a lesser claim, which is, I bought it from him, who bought it from you, that will be considered a valid claim. Because your lack of objection over here is clearly because you knew the sale went through and you signed onto this sale. Given that you signed onto the sale, then your lack of objection over here is an indication that I really am the owner of the property based on this migo. Balei HaTosfot here do ask a question about that migo. Why is he making a claim that I bought it from your husband who bought it from you. And Migo, that he could have said, I bought it directly from you. Therefore, he is believed over here. Why doesn't he just say that the Migo is, I bought it from your husband who bought it from you? Because me, I could have said that I bought it from your husband and you also signed on to it and you also sold it to me. Because that would have also been a valid sale. But I just vote, raise it as a question. Others say that that is exactly what the Migo is over here. The Migo is that since he said, I bought it from your husband who bought it from you, he's believed because he could have said, I bought it from your husband and I bought it from you. As Tosfo points out, this, the time period that he eats it before the Baal cannot be added to the time period that he eats it in front of the woman. So, I mean, it can't be 3 years between the two of them. And you can say, listen, when your husband passed away, you never came and objected. That's not enough. You need 3 full years in front of the woman because that's what gives you the Migo. The whole Migo is premised on the fact that you say, I bought it directly from you. That's what gives you believability that I bought it from the husband and your husband bought it from you and he sold it to me and that's why I have rights over here. But if he only ate it 1.5 years by when the husband was alive and 1.5 years after he passed away, that would not establish a chazaka over here. Now, the other thing is, Rav Yosef's explanation does run into a problem, which is that we have a principle that if you entered into a property with reshut, with permission, you no longer have a right or an ability to establish a chazaka on it. So for instance, an aris, a sharecropper. Sharecropper who entered onto a property as a sharecropper, he can never establish a chazaka because being a sharecropper, by definition, gave him permission to be on the property. Once he had permission to be on the property, his remaining on the property can't establish a chazaka. Why don't we say the same thing over here? This individual entered the property with permission because he bought it from the husband. He bought that right from the husband. Even if he only bought the right to the output from the husband, he still would be entitled to be on the property. That means that he entered the property with reshut. How come then, after the passing of the husband, does he have a right to establish a chazaka? He entered the property with permission. He didn't change anything. If you entered a property with permission and then continue to act in the same way going forward, that doesn't establish a chazaka, because the whole reason you got there was with permission. That's why there was no objection. So how do we differentiate this from a normal case? So way at the bottom, the Rashbam tells you what the difference is. It's the third to last line in the Rashbam. It's not similar to Arish. Ein yachol liton lekachti v'achreikein. He doesn't have a right after entering it as a sharecropper to say, I bought it. Mishum de stamaris, ein zman arisato. There is no automatic termination of a sharecropper. A sharecropper in general is there forever. And therefore, when he switches from being an aris to an owner, there's no indication, there's no demarcating line that shows us that it changed. And the lack of objection is just because I thought you were acting like an aris or continue to acting like aris. El kol yamin b'terat arisato omedet. Avazeh, shalokcha min ha'ish, Amanat shim yamut yafsid mekcho, that this individual, if he really bought it from the husband, and he only bought the lease rights, he did not buy the principal rights, then when the husband passes away, he would have to leave. There's an automatic termination of his rights over here. She told Isha nichsei malok, because then the wife is going to come and exercise her principal rights and take it back. Hatam vada kishemet ba'al arizek ilu yored achshav michadash l'tzadeh shel isa zo. It's as if there was a new beginning to his relationship with this property, a new term. Because at the time of the death of the husband, the nature of the relationship changed. It's no longer him being there like he was before. His staying there now is superseding the rights of the woman to the land. Beforehand, his rights to it were simply that he bought it from the husband and maybe just bought the usage rights. And he should have been kicked off at that point. The fact that at that point she doesn't kick him off means that his staying on the property is as if he started from scratch and re-entered the property at this point in time. So that's how the Rashbam differentiates between the cases and says that Rav Yosef's case is different than the case of an aris, and that's what entitles him to establish a chazaka over here, even though he entered the property originally with permission. The Ramban, on the other hand, claims that it's a case here where we don't have any evidence to the fact that he was there before the death of the husband. We only have a deem about the time period afterwards. And therefore, his yored birshut, we don't have evidence to, and that's why he's able to establish a chazaka over here. Or even if normally a yored birshut doesn't gain a chazaka, over here where he's been there for a long duration of time, the woman should have spoken up because people might forget the fact that he entered there when the husband was still alive to establish a chazaka, and therefore the woman should have objected, and her lack of objection, in essence, becomes an acquiescence to his ownership over there. Gufa, Amarav, ein machzikim b'nichsei eshedish. He says that you don't have a right to take possession of the property of an eshedish. That would go against what he said before. V'tanyei gola, amarim machzikin. The Dineni Gola say you can't take possession of it. Amarav, Alocha, Ki Dineni Gola. Rav says the Alocha are like the Dineni Gola. The Dineni Gola, as the Rashbam points out, are Shmuel and Karna. That we say in Sanhedrin, they're considered to be the Dayanim of the Gola. So Amalei, Rav Kahana, Rav Asi, the Rav, they say to him, V'hodar Be'mar Mishmatei, wait a minute, did you back away from your position? You said before, Ein Machzikim B'nechsei Esherish. You do not have the ability to establish a possession or a chazakah on the properties of Nesherish. Now that would go against what Rav said before, which is, Esherish Trichala Mechot, that Nesherish needs to object. The fact that she needs to object shows that you can establish a chazakah, and that's like the conclusion that he says over here, that Dayanei Gola say that you do have a right to establish a chazakah in an Eshadish's property. And so now we have a steer in Rav, and what Rav Kahana, Rav Asi, Talmidim of Rav, are asking him, did you change your mind about this? So Amar Lahu, Mistavra, Amrei Ki Rav Yosef. He says, yeah, the way they explain it is like Rav Yosef. Now obviously Rav never said that, because Rav would never have seen Rav Yosef. Rav is significantly older than Rav Yosef, and Rav and Rav Yosef are three generations after Rav. It's not going to be that Rav says, oh, like Rav Yosef. But what the Gemara is saying is, the way to reconcile Rav is to use Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef here differentiated in the nature of how you're trying to establish a chazakah. When Rav says, "Ein machzikim be'nechsei shadish," when he says you can't establish a chazakah in the property of an shadish, that's in a case where it's either the husband trying to establish a chazakah, or a person is trying to establish a chazakah without being there 3 years after the passing of the husband. In that case, Rav says you can't establish a chazakah. On the other hand, if it's a case where the person was on the property b'chaye abal, and then after the baal passed away, he remained there for 3 years, then you can establish a chazakah, and that's like the Dayanei Gola. That's when I hold like Shmuel, and that's when I said before that the Eshadish needs to object. If she doesn't object, then she's going to lose the property. So that's how we explain or reconcile Rav. Even though Rav seemingly has a contradictory opinion with regards to whether you can establish a chazakah with an Eshadish or not, we'll make the same distinction that we ourselves made in order to solve the problem for Rav versus our Mishnah. We'll make that same distinction within Rav's position itself. And that is that sometimes Rav says, yes, a chazakah works. Those are the cases, like Rav Yosef laid out, where you've been there before and then you stayed 3 years after the passing of the husband. There you can establish a chazakah, and there the woman will have to speak up and object. Otherwise, she will lose the rights to the property. On the other hand, while she's married, a third party cannot establish a chazakah on the property because she said, I relied on my husband. And given that I relied on my husband, I didn't object, or my silence was not an acquiescence, as well as the fact that the husband cannot establish a chazakah because of the fact that the husband is there with rights. The woman says that I didn't object because you were using the property like you normally would use it. We did have that one exception, possibly, which is where he damages the property, whether the husband can establish a chazakah that way because then he's not utilizing it the normal way that people would normally use the property. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots in the top of Nun Aleph, Amud Aleph.